The College of New Jersey, now Princeton University, expected that their new freshman, James Madison, could translate Virgil and Cicero from the Latin, and the Gospels from the original Greek, could express himself effectively in Latin. For Madison, none of that was a problem. He had already read authors including Homer, Virgil, Horace, Julius Caesar, Tacitus, Lucretius, Herodotus, Thucydides, and Plato in the original languages. Welcome to the second lecture in Wyoming Catholic College's distance learning series, The Classical Roots of American Liberty. This is Director of Distance Learning, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. Like James Madison, before Alexander Hamilton and John Jay entered what is now Columbia University, they had also mastered Greek and Latin grammar, read Cicero and Virgil's Aeneid in the original Latin, and were adept at translating the New Testament from the original Greek into Latin. They had to be. The college required that for admissions. Years after graduating from college, Madison, Hamilton, and Jay authored the Federalist Papers. These were essays describing the nature, the limits, and the benefits of the U.S. Constitution and the experiment in ordered liberty it represented. Without their practical and philosophical defense of the Constitution, ratification would have been unlikely. How much did their early education in the classics influence their practical and philosophical understanding of this new government that they were bringing into being? In this lecture, The Greek and Roman Roots of the American Experiment, Dr. Pavlos Papadopoulos explores how the ancients influenced the newly founded republic.
The title for my lecture is The Greek and Roman Roots of the American Experiment. Because that seemed too narrow and limited a topic for one whole lecture, I've added a subtitle, Liberty and Political History, which I'll explain in a moment. First, I'd like to note some potential objections to the lecture's title. Is the American experiment really rooted in ancient Greece and Rome? Aren't there many and profound differences between classical politics and modern politics? Differences in scale, differences in forms, differences in means and in ends, differences in belief and socioeconomic conditions? Don't these differences outweigh whatever similarities we might see between the American Republic and the ancient polities of Greece and Rome? Moreover, didn't the American founders themselves say that they were establishing something new, something different in the world, that they were not transplanting the ancient city to the new world as if such a thing were desirable or even possible? Shouldn't we trust the founders to understand what they were doing and therefore distrust any suggestion that the American experiment has Greek and Roman roots? These objections have some real merits to them. The historical differences, including the difference between the pagan religions that were at home in the ancient city and the biblical Christianity that has formed America, cannot be ignored. And it is plainly written in documents such as the Federalist Papers that the American founders explicitly rejected certain aspects of classical politics and claimed that their grand experiment was informed by new principles. But neither this rejection nor this innovation was wholesale. Rightly understood, the American order has multiple roots. The great 20th century conservative intellectual, Russell Kirk, famously described these diverse roots by reference to five cities: Athens, Jerusalem, Rome, London, and finally Philadelphia. I won't be following Kirk's five cities paradigm in this lecture, but I mention it to point out that when we say that America has Greek and Roman roots, we do not thereby exclude other sources for our identity and self-understanding. Indeed, it can be tempting to overstate the way in which the American Republic departed from the wisdom and practice of the classics. This temptation is all the more difficult to resist if we imagine, wrongly, I think, that the American Republic is simply a manifestation of the principles of modern or Enlightenment political philosophy, in contrast to an imagined Greek and Roman political reality that is, again wrongly, a manifestation of the principles of classical political philosophy. Here, I will be arguing that the American Republic could not have been established without our founders' deep knowledge of, respect for, and indebtedness to the classical experience and classical analysis of political communities. In fact, it was in large part due to their knowledge of history, the history of ancient as well as modern political orders, that the American founders constituted the United States as they did. More than just the knowledge of ancient history, I will argue that it was a classical mode of studying history, a classical understanding of the proper means and proper ends of historical study that informed the American founding. I hope to show in this lecture that the affinities between our founding understanding of political history and that of ancient Greece and Rome are sufficiently substantial to justify the image conjured by our title, that at least some of the roots of American liberty stretch back to classical antiquity. To be sure, there are certain significant, even determinative, ideas, such as natural law, that were articulated in the classical period and carried forward into the American Republic. When we speak of political liberty, we must remember that it is the exception in human societies rather than the rule. Free societies are difficult to establish and difficult to maintain. Part of the reason for this rarity and precariousness is that political liberty assumes certain ideas, certain well-grounded beliefs and convictions about human nature, about justice, and about political life. Ideas which are readily assailed by sophisticated opponents, like the kind that first appeared in antiquity and have never quite gone away. The articulation, defense, and transmission of those ideas occurs in part through formal education. Accordingly, political liberty calls for a specific form of education. This is one of the reasons that a liberal education is called liberal education, because it cultivates the capacity for citizenship in its students, because it nourishes a free political order. In this lecture, I will argue for the importance of political history in the education required for liberty. This is an importance that the ancient Greeks and Romans recognized, and that the American founders recognized as well. Indeed, it is something that Americans in general, regular citizens as well as politicians and educators, recognized until somewhat recently, but has fallen out of favor during the last two or three generations. Having seen how and why the ancient Greeks and Romans, as well as the American founders, appreciated the role of political history in an education for liberty, we might consider how to restore the study of political history to its proper place in our time, and thereby contribute to the preservation and restoration of American liberty. But first, what do I mean by political history? Simply put, the study of history that examines the actions and speeches of political leaders, their relationships with their people, the developments within political regimes, and the relations between political communities. Political history investigates the decisions of citizens and statesmen, the causes and conditions for those decisions, as well as their effects. Political history necessarily involves a study of political ideas, because our ideas exercise such great influence over our choices. This is implied by the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration begins by promising to declare the causes which impel the colonies to separate from the British Empire. What immediately follows this promise is not the list of grievances against King and Parliament, which we might point to as the most obvious immediate causes of the colonies' separation from Great Britain. Instead, before listing these grievances, the Declaration declares, "We hold these truths to be self-evident," and proceeds to sketch the political principles that Americans hold dear: natural equality, natural God-given rights, the purpose of government, consent of the governed, the right of revolution, and popular sovereignty. In other words, the primary cause which impels the colonies to declare their independence from Britain is what they believe, the self-evident truths. Crucially, the truths that were self-evident to the Americans of the time, we hold these truths to be self-evident, about human nature, the purpose of government, and the political philosophy built on these principles. It is because Americans held these beliefs that they reacted to Britain's long train of abuses and usurpations by declaring their independence. The Declaration of Independence reveals that we cannot really understand the choices made by citizens, statesmen, and nations unless we understand the beliefs that motivated their decisions. Thus, the study of ideas is a necessary part of, or complement to, the study of political history. That said, political history is distinct from intellectual history. It is not limited to the study of political ideas, for example, the ideas of the American founding, as they have been formulated and fallen in and out of favor over time. That is sometimes called the history of political thought. Instead, by studying deliberations and decisions, actions and events, political history shows the influence that certain ideas exercised over specific individuals and nations in a given set of circumstances. Political history thus affords its students the opportunity to examine, test, and compare competing ideas about justice, government, and the nature of society. Events serve as vivid examples of ideas in action. They help us understand the consequences of holding certain beliefs, as well as the consequences of having the conviction to act on them. Political history does not directly study the validity or truth or adequacy of such beliefs. That, we might say, is the job of philosophy. What political history does do is show us what it means for a person or a polity to hold one belief or another, what effects such beliefs have on their actions, and what are the consequences of their actions. Given that politics belongs in the practical realm of action rather than the speculative realm of theory, knowing what effects a belief will have is at least as important as determining whether it is true. Indeed, this is a reasonable way to explore its adequacy, if not its validity. So rather than posing questions about the conduct of politics in the abstract, political history allows questions to arise from particular incidents through an examination of how politically relevant ideas were articulated and received and held, how choices were made, how speeches were delivered and deeds performed, and how events unfolded. It thereby gives its students good material to reason through such arguments. We have before us dramatic examples instead of hypotheticals. Rather than a treatise about political principles and the ideas that derive from them, we are able to see how choices are made and actions are performed on the basis of beliefs and perceptions, convictions and judgments. Now, the American founders were very well read in political history, including the classical political historians of ancient Greece and Rome. This is in part because the dominant educational institution of the colonial period was the classical liberal arts college. Classical because such colleges read the great books of Greek and Latin antiquity, and liberal arts because such colleges were devoted to teaching the arts of liberty, the trivium and the quadrivium, which were understood to be essential for personal liberty and the liberty of a political community. But over the last century and a half, the liberal arts college and classical studies have been dethroned from their previously exalted place in American society. In part as a result of this revolution, political history is not the kind of history in which many of us today have been educated. Schools today often teach a form of social history or cultural history rather than political history. Political history used to be the dominant field within the historical profession in the United States, but in the last half of the 20th century, social historians overtook political historians among university professors. And this has had a trickle-down effect into primary and secondary education, where history itself is sometimes supplanted by social studies. Social or cultural history, sometimes called the history of the people, inverts the emphasis on political elites in favor of studying the way in which ordinary people lived in the past. The implication, and sometimes it's more than an implication, is that society, rather than the political order, is the most important kind of human association to study if one wishes to understand human existence in history. Accordingly, it is the study of social groups, rather than the study of political regimes and the decisions of citizens and statesmen, that takes priority. And more often than not, society is conceived of not as the product of human actions and choices, but as a concatenation of innumerable material factors. And increasingly, social history itself is fragmenting into the history of subcultures or identity groups contained within, without quite composing, society at large. And yet, political history continues to be popular among the reading and viewing public. You can still walk into any bookstore and find biographies of great statesmen and generals, kings and queens, and presidents or prime ministers. Or you can go on Amazon, because no one goes to bookstores anymore. You can find at the movie theaters, or again streaming on Netflix, masterfully rendered dramatizations of important episodes from political history. For example, Winston Churchill's process of deliberation and decision in May 1940 not to enter into peace negotiations with Hitler, portrayed in the 2017 film Darkest Hour, starring Gary Oldman, or Abraham Lincoln's masterful politicking in the final months of the Civil War to secure the passage of the 13th Amendment, portrayed in the 2012 Steven Spielberg film Lincoln. The enduring popularity of political history suggests that we, the people, somehow suspect that a merely social approach to history is insufficient. Social history can be a fascinating and valuable approach to the study of the past. At its best, it can provide a crucial complement to political history. day-to-day life in a specific time and place, both influences and is influenced by the grand decisions of statesmen, diplomats, and military leaders. But at its worst, social history can suggest to its students that the course of history is not just largely, but entirely beyond the influence of human choice, denying the reality of human freedom. And social history can distort our understanding of human nature in another way. We are, as Aristotle describes us, not merely social animals, but political animals. It is in our nature not just to be members of a social group, but to be members of a political order, a specific city or nation. Because we possess reason, we have thoughts and opinions about the nature of justice and advantage. And better still, we are able to reason toward the true meaning of justice and advantage, and deliberate with our fellow citizens about their realization in concrete present circumstances. As a result of our rational and political nature, when we look to the past, we want to see and understand the decisions that are made in critical moments. And we want to know what actions and outcomes resulted from these decisions. This is a good desire. It arises from our nature as rational and political animals, and if cultivated, it may form a part of our civic education as responsible citizens of a republic. I mentioned the popularity of social history as opposed to political history at the university level. It's worth pointing out that the study of any history at all is in general decline in the American academy. Here, I'm going to be focusing on the civic benefits of a revival of political history, the benefits to our nation, to preserving it as a free nation. But it would also be in the interest of the historians themselves to turn their attention back to political history, the kind of history that's popular among the reading and viewing public, if for no other reason than for the sake of their own job security. Let's turn now to the classical understanding of the study of politics and see what role political history has to play. We will then be in a position to see on this crucial point how the American Republic has been nourished by classical roots. We today, even those of us devoted to classical education, often overlook the classical historians in favor of the classical poets and philosophers. When we think of the great books of ancient Greece and Rome, it is easier to call to mind Homer and Hesiod, Sophocles and Aristophanes, Plato and Aristotle, Virgil and Marcus Aurelius, than it is to think of Herodotus and Thucydides, Livy and Tacitus. It is also tempting to overlook the very great importance of historical studies for political philosophers, such as Aristotle and Cicero. Perhaps this is because in the modern period, we tend to think of history as a rigorous scientific discipline, one of the social sciences, which is essentially concerned with establishing historical facts through the study of manuscripts, reliable testimonies, and above all, physical evidence. This modern notion of history as a science can lead us to be less forgiving of the apparently imprecise or unscientific character of the classical historians. Less forgiving of that than we are of the classical philosophers, who, after all, are merely philosophizing as opposed to practicing science, speculating as all humans do, rather than establishing facts as only a scientist can do. This condescension toward philosophy is, I think, greatly misguided, but in any case, the ancient philosophers themselves had a great appreciation for the role of history, and the ancient historians, too, understood their mode of studying history, which is, above all, a form of political history, to be an important enterprise. Let us look at what they said about their own field of study. And I'm going to look at Herodotus, Thucydides, and Livy in turn. Herodotus, the first great Greek historian, begins his work with the following declaration. Herodotus of Halicarnassus here presents his inquiries, so that the things generated by human beings do not fade with time, nor the great and wonderful deeds, some brought forth by the Greeks, others by the barbarians, go unsung. The word in Greek is akleia, literally, not lose their luster or not have their glory fade. And together with this, what cause led them to make war on each other? Here, Herodotus announces that he has three purposes. First, by writing his history, he is seeking to preserve all human things, all things generated by human beings. Humans are mortal, but writing can help us resist time, or at least can help preserve the things that we as human beings have generated, above all, our speeches and our deeds. Second, and more specifically, Herodotus is doing a kind of maintenance work on the glory or renown, the kleos, of human deeds. The great and wondrous deeds done by the Greeks and barbarians, which means anyone who's not Greek, will lose their luster if they aren't recorded and re-presented by an author. This is more than mere preservation, and it's more specific than things generated by human beings. Herodotus focuses above all on the speeches and deeds that are considered great and wondrous, that is, awe-inspiring. Herodotus still has one foot in the tradition of epic poetry, or perhaps it is better to say he is engaging in a conversation or competition with the epic poetry of Homer. This helps explain the language of this second goal of history writing. Kleos, glory or renown, is what the warriors in the Trojan War fought for, and what they were so anxious to have live on after them, and which did live on after them through Homer's poetry. Herodotus suggests that he, too, can preserve the glory of great and wondrous deeds. Third, Herodotus inquires into the cause of the war between the Persians and the Greeks. Who was at fault? What is to blame? What were the chain of causes that led to the two failed Persian invasions of Greece and the successful Greek counterattack? It's worth noting that the Greek word for history, historia, is not just limited to the study of the past. Primarily, it means an inquiry. Herodotus' third and final goal in his history is to inquire into the causes of events, to discover what led to the effects that are the most obvious content of historical study. And the way he goes about inquiring into causes is indicated by his first goal in writing history, to preserve very broadly the things generated by human beings. In his work, Herodotus explores not just events or things said, but everything we as human beings have generated, and everything that in turn has helped to form our own generative acts, including everything that we today would call culture. Customs, laws, myths, ideas about what is noble and beautiful and honorable and just, beliefs about the nature of the gods and fate and death, religious practices, attitudes toward art, as well as geography, climate, and so on. So far, Herodotus's understanding of history might seem only tangentially related to political liberty. To be sure, the primary subject of his history is the great struggle between the Greek cities and the Persian Empire. And this is a struggle that everyone involved, the Greeks, the Persians, Herodotus himself, describes as a battle between liberty and tyranny, the attempt by the Greeks to preserve their freedom from Persian despotism. But here, as he introduces his work, Herodotus's interests appear so general that they might seem to have little to do with the cultivation and preservation of liberty. Why should we, as citizens studying political history, care about the glorious deeds of the Greeks and barbarians? Moreover, what possible use could the knowledge of the customs and beliefs of ancient peoples, which is what Herodotus spends a great deal of his work describing, have for liberty-loving citizens in a distant place or time? Let me address this concern with two remarks. First, as with the Declaration of Independence, Herodotus recognizes that the causes of events are not simply what immediately precedes them in time. Herodotus's histories is full of apparent digressions and, let's be honest, outright irrelevancies about the customs, myths, beliefs, and backgrounds of the Greeks and Persians, to say nothing of the Lydians, Scythians, Egyptians, Indians, and other nations discussed in the course of his work. The early pages of Book 1 catalog several different accounts of the origin of the conflict between the Greeks and the barbarians, an account given by the Persians, one given by the Phoenicians, and finally one given by Herodotus himself. Why bother to describe the Persian account if Herodotus is going to give his own? As it turns out, what Herodotus relates to us as the Persian understanding of the origins of the war reveals something about the soul of the Persians, the culture of the Persians, their understanding of beauty and nobility, their understanding of freedom and empire. And this in turn helps explain the contrast between how and why the Persians, as opposed to the Greeks, wage war. In the language of the Declaration of Independence, what the Persians and Greek hold as their self-evident truths, not just about politics, but about all aspects of the human condition, are the most fundamental causes of their actions. Political history, as practiced by Herodotus, must inquire not only into the series of decisions and actions that are, so to speak, on the surface of history. Herodotus must also inquire into these root causes of human action, our deepest beliefs and self-understandings. Second, Herodotus reveals his goal in writing a history that will help preserve political liberty through the episodes he chooses to emphasize. I will give one example of this. His work ends with what seems to be an out-of-place digression. The Greeks have successfully repelled the Persian invasions and have gone on the offensive, liberating Greek cities in Asia from the rule of the Persians. While describing the fate of a certain Persian governor, Herodotus takes us back in time to an ancestor of that governor, who lived during the reign of Cyrus the Great, the founder of the Persian Empire. The Persians, who come from a tough and rocky land, were just beginning to conquer their neighbors, and it was proposed to Cyrus that the Persians should uproot themselves from their homeland and resettle these newly conquered, far more fertile lands. Herodotus said, "They may do so, but if they do, they should be prepared to be rulers no longer, but rather to become subjects under the rule of others. For," he said, "soft places tend to produce soft men." Cyrus warned the Persians, who were able to conquer their neighbors because they were tougher than them, against becoming decadent and luxurious, and thus falling under the rule of others. Several generations later, during the Persian invasions of Greece, and when Herodotus himself is writing, it is the Greeks who are a tough people from a rocky land, who successfully resist being conquered by a soft and decadent Persian Empire. Herodotus thus ends his history with a warning to his audience. The Greeks, who live in a poor and rocky land, have just displayed their power in fighting off the Persians. They may be tempted to make the same mistake that the Persians made, to neglect the warning of Cyrus, to let their martial spirit be corrupted by the spoils of victory, to trade their self-sufficiency and liberty for a temporary enjoyment that would ultimately undermine their ability to preserve themselves in freedom. So, Herodotus' conclusion reveals at least one of the goals of history as he understands it, to provide a warning to those living in the present not to repeat the mistakes of the past. We turn now to the other great Greek historian, Thucydides, who belongs to the generation after Herodotus. He is even more explicit in articulating the purpose of political history. Thucydides wrote of the great war that followed the Persian Wars, what happened when the foremost Greek cities, Athens and Sparta, had fended off the Persian invasion, began to build their own empires over the other Greek cities, and eventually came to wage a long and brutal war against each other. In the early 17th century, Thomas Hobbes produced the first English translation of Thucydides. At the beginning of his translation, he provides an excellent description of the classical understanding of the purpose and means of political history. Hobbes writes that, quote, "The principal and proper work of history is to instruct and enable men, by the knowledge of actions past, to bear themselves prudently in the present and providently toward the future." Here, Hobbes is echoing Thucydides' own statement about the nature of historical inquiry. In the first book of his history, Thucydides writes, quote, "I will be content if my history be judged useful by that inquirer who desires an exact knowledge of the past as an aid to the understanding of the future, which, in the course of human things, must resemble if it does not reflect it. I have written my work not as an essay which is to win the applause of the moment, but as a possession for all time." Thucydides is quite direct about the political utility of political history, indeed, the dependence of the political art upon knowledge of history. Let's unpack his reasoning. Every political regime requires some men, its leaders, to bear themselves prudently in the present and providently toward the future. Politics requires prudence, the virtue of practical wisdom, the intellectual excellence by which we perceive what can be done and what ought to be done in the present moment. As Aristotle puts it, the political association aims at securing justice and advantage for itself, for its citizens. Prudence is the ability to see what is just and what is advantageous in the present moment and to act accordingly. Moreover, it is only through knowledge that we are able to bear ourselves providently toward the future, that is, to do what it is possible to do with our present actions and within the scope of human power to provide for ourselves and for our community, to ensure that the conditions of life and the good life continue to obtain. History illuminates how citizens, statesmen, cities, and empires have acted in the past, and therefore it offers some indications of how they might be expected to act in the present. Political history thus serves a political or civic function. It seeks to educate citizens and statesmen in the virtue of prudence and the ability to provide for themselves and their polity. There is an unstated premise in what both Thucydides and Hobbes say about the utility of history. Both authors believe that human nature is essentially unchanging over time, that the politically most important features of human nature were the same in the 5th century BC as they were in the 17th century AD, and as they will continue to be in the 21st and 22nd and 23rd centuries as well. What are these politically relevant, permanent features of human nature? Time and again in his history, Thucydides shows how a variety of human passions, desires, and beliefs motivate or sway the decisions of cities. For example, fear of another's power, or fear of losing one's own power, ambition to exercise dominion over others, the desire to secure one's own advantage, or the desire to act honorably, the belief that performing a certain action will be noble or ignoble, the belief that one has the right to exercise authority over others, righteous or unrighteous, indignation at the actions of others, the belief that one has been wronged, or the guilty conscience that one is oneself in the wrong. All of these sentiments loom large in the history of the Peloponnesian War, and all of them recur again and again to the present day. They recur because, whatever difference there may be in conditions, the main actors in political history, which is to say human beings, are the same in these crucial respects. The role that human passions, desires, and beliefs play in politics can shed some light on how Thucydides chooses to introduce his history. In explaining why he chose to write about the Peloponnesian War, Thucydides says that it is, quote, the greatest movement yet known in history, not only of the Greeks, but of a large part of the barbarian world, I almost said of mankind. It was, Thucydides goes on to show, greater in scale than the other great wars that loomed large in the Greek mind, the Trojan War of the mythic past and the recently concluded Persian Wars. Now, why does Thucydides choose to describe the war as a movement, a motion? It makes him sound more like a natural scientist, a physicist, than a historian, as if Thucydides understood himself to be a political physicist. What could he mean by this? In the most obvious sense, the war is a motion in that it involves the movement of a great number of soldiers, horses, ships, and so on, from one part of Greece to another. Invasions, sieges, battles, and even civil wars, motions or convulsions within a city. But what is the cause of these motions? The most famous feature of Thucydides' history is his speeches, the great speeches given by political leaders to persuade their fellow citizens that now is the time for war or now is the time for peace, the speeches given by the representatives of one city to another that they should enter into an alliance or break off relations with a former ally. So we can see Thucydides, the political physicist, investigating the motion of the war by tracing the causes back to the great speeches, which set cities and armies and navies into motion, and then further back, tracing these causes to the passions and desires and beliefs and hopes of the speakers and their audiences, the movements in the souls of human beings that cause them to make an argument or to be persuaded by an argument. Thucydides, like Herodotus and like the Declaration of Independence, understood that the deepest cause for which men make war and peace is to be found in the soul, in what the persons and nations involved take seriously, what they take to be self-evident, what they love and cherish and desire and understand. Now, if this endurance of human nature over time were not the case, then knowledge of actions past would have no necessary bearing on actions in the present and the future. There would be no reason to suppose that such historical knowledge would enable men to bear themselves prudently in the present and providently toward the future. As it is, Thucydides thinks that there will be some resemblance or reflection between and among the past, present, and future. Thus, the ancient historian can say that his history is intended to be a possession for all time. So long as human beings are human beings, their past actions will provide some indication of their present and future actions. Thucydides is humble about the degree of precision that historical study can bring to bear on understanding present and future actions, and I've tried to reflect his humility by qualifying my statements that the past will provide some indication of present and future. Thucydides, like Aristotle, recognized the degree of precision that is appropriate for political and historical studies. That is to say, the precision that we should expect whenever we are studying human affairs. In his Nicomachean Ethics, which together with the Politics forms his two-part philosophy of human affairs, Aristotle articulates this classical view of the kind of precision that one should expect in studying human things. He says that in the study of human actions, one must be content with, quote, demonstrating the truth roughly and in outline. For, he says, one is always speaking about and on the basis of things that are, for the most part, so. And thus, Aristotle says, one must draw conclusions of that sort as well, conclusions that are, for the most part, so. Aristotle sums up this view in a maxim, quote, it belongs to an educated person to seek out precision in each genus to the extent that the nature of the matter allows. In other words, classical political science is practiced by Aristotle, and classical political history is practiced by Herodotus and Thucydides, does not seek to be predictive. It is foolish to expect the study of politics or of history to result in predictions in the manner in which physics can predict the trajectory of a cannonball. This does not mean that there is no precision in the study of human things. Rather, it means that there is an appropriate precision. The unpredictability of human affairs results from the complexity of human nature, above all, our freedom and will, a complexity that complicates any calculative or predictive approach. Politics and history are not rocket science. They're far more complex than rocket science, because their subject matter, human beings, cannot be reduced to quantifiable factors that obey universal laws. Let me now briefly consider a Roman historian who, like Thucydides, the political physicist, compares himself to another kind of scientist, a physician. Titus Livy wrote a comprehensive history of Rome from the foundations of the city to his own time, the end of the Roman Republic and the dawn of the empire under Augustus Caesar. He begins his history on a nostalgic note, praising the virtue of the early Romans and bemoaning the moral and political decline of his own time. Surely this sounds familiar to us. But he does not think of history as an exercise in escapism. He writes, quote, the study of history is the best medicine for a sick mind. For in history, you have a record of the infinite variety of human experience plainly set out for all to see. And in that record, you can find, for yourself and for your country, both examples and warnings, fine things to take as models, base things rotten through and through to avoid. History, for Livy, is a medicine, but not in the sense of a painkiller or a sedative. History is not merely a way to dull the pain, to distract oneself from the vices and decadence of the present. Instead, history, rightly written and rightly read, can be a means to curing the sickness of the present. The history of good times, the profitable choices of virtuous citizens, and the well-ordered structures of flourishing polities provides a model to be imitated. The history of bad times, by contrast, provides cautionary tales. Moreover, by showing how the one has turned into the other, how a good city can degenerate into a bad one, how unscrupulous men can rise to power, or even how the virtues of political order can be revived, that's the most difficult one, the political historian can serve his country in the present and the future. The record of history provides models, both negative and positive, both for yourself and your country. Livy does not assert that it is always possible to reform a country or an individual by learning from examples of the past, but he does think that the study of history is practical, not just in the sense of studying practical matters, speeches and deeds, but also in its effect. Political history provides us with lessons, with an education in healing our present woes. We have seen that political history, as understood by the classics, is political in two ways, in its subject matter and in its use. It is concerned with political deeds, with political speeches, with the choices that underlie such deeds and speeches, and with the qualities of soul, the aspects of human nature, that in turn lead to such choices. In addition, political history has a civic or political function. It provides an education for statesmen and citizens. A well-governed city or nation requires virtuous citizens and virtuous statesmen, including the virtue of prudence, which for Aristotle is the intellectual virtue concerned with action. Practical wisdom, the virtue that oversees and enables the execution of all the moral virtues. Prudence, in turn, requires experience. It is not enough to know what is right or good or just or advantageous in a general or universal sense. The prudent man is the one who is able to see it and recognize it in a particular set of circumstances, and experience provides practice in this skill of seeing rightly. This is why, according to Aristotle, it is possible for very young people to be brilliant mathematical geniuses, but not to be prudent. It takes time to acquire the requisite experience. But how can we acquire experience to choose rightly, to choose prudently, without going through a process of trial and error, without choosing wrongly first, and thereby learning how to choose rightly? This difficulty cannot be entirely avoided, but it can be mitigated by an education in history. History, like literature, provides us with a wealth of vicarious experience, imaginative or actual examples of prudent and imprudent decision-making, and thereby it aids us in developing prudence. When we turn to the American founders, we find them deeply appreciative of the need for prudence, and, accordingly, of the need for experience. Americans of the 18th century were already politically experienced in the ordinary, direct sense of the word. Some of the colonies had enjoyed domestic self-government for over 150 years before they declared independence. During the Revolutionary period, they all gained practice in writing republican constitutions for themselves. And they had all experienced the deprivation of self-government in the 1760s and 70s as the British Parliament arrogated to itself legislative power over the colonies, and the British King first stood by and then actively supported this parliamentary overreach. The American people at the time of the Revolution had ample direct experience of political matters, and in the years under the Articles of Confederation, they gained, as Hamilton says in Federalist 1, full experience of the insufficiencies of the existing federal government, an unhappy experience that led them to the Constitutional Convention of 1787. Indeed, we find ample evidence of their appreciation of the second kind of experience, the vicarious experience granted through knowledge of history, in the Federalist Papers themselves, the great cooperative effort by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay, writing under the pseudonym Publius, to persuade their countrymen to ratify the newly framed United States Constitution. Throughout the Federalist, the authors demonstrate their own deep knowledge of political history, and they also assume this knowledge on the part of their audience. The history of their own colonies, from their origins to the present time, the long and turbulent history of their mother country, the history of the great European nations of the early modern and medieval periods, the history of the city-states of Renaissance Italy, and the ancient history of Greece and Rome. In response to the question I posed not long ago, how can we acquire the experience that is necessary to choosing rightly without suffering through the pains of first having chosen wrongly? That would be really nice. John Jay says the following in Federalist Number 5, quote, "The history of Great Britain is the one with which we are in general the best acquainted, and it gives us many useful lessons. We may profit by their experience without paying the price which it cost them." Hamilton, Madison, and Jay shared with the classical historians an understanding of the twofold political nature of political history. Their frequent appeals to history or experience in the Federalist Papers offer ample testimony of this fact. Allow me to briefly review the ways in which Publius uses the word experience. Here is an incomplete list of what experience does in the Federalist. Experience teaches. It testifies, it guides human opinions, it admonishes, it attests, it confirms, it instructs, it assures, it vouches, it presents to mankind political lessons, it corroborates, it justifies, and, on one occasion, it affords an illustrious comment. Experience, according to Hamilton in Federalist 6, is the least fallible guide of human opinions. In Federalist 15, he calls it the best oracle of wisdom, while Madison calls it the oracle of truth in Federalist 20. In Federalist 52, Madison refers to experience as that guide that ought always be followed whenever it can be found. And in Federalist 72, Hamilton announces that experience is the parent of wisdom, is an adage, the truth of which is recognized by the wisest as well as the simplest of mankind. As for history, in the course of the Federalist Papers, Publius tells us that it is, and again, this is an incomplete list, that history exhibits, warrants, compels us to conclude, reports, informs us, instructs, teaches, warrants, proves, displays the infirmities and depravities of human nature, and furnishes us with so many mortifying examples. Throughout the Federalist, history is appealed to as a field in which to discover political principles or to confirm what reason suggests. Induction, reasoning from a wealth of examples to general principles, is a vital mode of argumentation for historical and political questions. The founders shared with Aristotle and the classical historians the understanding that, while human affairs are not subject to the same precision as the mathematical sciences, nevertheless, they do have a precision appropriate to them. In Federalist 4, Jay, arguing that a disunited States of America would be easily divided and conquered by foreign powers, writes, quote, "The history of the states of Greece and of other countries abound with such instances, and it is not improbable that what has so often happened would, under similar circumstances, happen again." The same premise underlies Jay's declaration as underlies Thucydides' and Hobbes' statements about the purpose of history. The permanent qualities of human nature makes it possible for us to examine the tremendous variations that occur over time and discover evidence for and against the arguments of practical reason. In other words, to discover guides for prudent conduct. Hamilton, Madison, and Jay recognize that prudence depends in part on experience, and that the truths that are relevant to practical matters are best sought in experience, be it direct or indirect. Whenever possible, at every stage of their argument in favor of union and constitution as the best practicable arrangement of affairs for the new nation, they looked to political history for evidence and guidance. In this, the Federalist Papers reflects a broad appreciation for history in the founding period. They demonstrate the conviction held by the founders that a free people, a people capable of responsible self-government, must be educated in political history. I'll conclude by looking briefly at two other founders. John Adams, writing his Thoughts on Government in the spring of 1776, a document that would go on to influence the new constitutions of at least five of the 13 states, called for laws for the liberal education of youth, which he said were so extremely wise and useful that, to a humane and generous mind, no expense for this purpose would be thought extravagant. You can tell that to your parents. He certainly had in mind political history as a vital component of a liberal education. As a young man, Adams had encouraged himself, writing in his diary, to, quote, "labor to get ideas of law, right, wrong, justice, equity," to, quote, "search for them in your own mind, in Roman, Grecian, French, English treatises of natural, civil, common, statute law," to aim at an exact knowledge of the nature, end, and means of government, and to compare the different forms of it with each other, and each of them with their effects on public and private happiness. As a mature man, Adams spent his leisure time, in his own description, examining the systems of all the legislators, ancient and modern, fantastical and real, and tracing their effects in history upon the felicity of mankind. And he dove deep into history in his great defense of colonial self-government, a dissertation on the canon and feudal law, published shortly after the Stamp Act of 1765, in the course of which he exhorted his audience to, quote, "read the histories of ancient ages, contemplate the great examples of Greece and Rome, set before us the conduct of our own British ancestors, read and recollect and impress upon our souls the views and ends of our own more immediate forefathers, recollect the civil and religious principles and hopes and expectations which constantly supported them through all hardships." And when, in 1779, Adams drafted the Constitution of Massachusetts, he included among the purposes of the state government that it foster wisdom and knowledge as well as virtue in the citizens by establishing or supporting institutions of education from the public and grammar schools to the university level. Throughout his life, Adams was working within the classical tradition of education, which, whatever its fate in the old world during the 17th and 18th centuries, had been successfully transplanted to the British colonies in the form of liberal arts colleges, which dotted the Atlantic coastline and continued to flourish into the 19th century. We may look to Adams's great partner and rival in founding and governing the American Republic, Thomas Jefferson, to sum up the significance of an education in political history as part of the liberal education that was required for citizenship in a republic. Jefferson wished for the memories of all the children of Virginia to be, quote, stored with the most useful facts from Grecian, Roman, European, and American history as part of his scheme of general education, which must, quote, render the people the safe, as they are the ultimate guardians of their own liberty. Jefferson emphasized the political or civic goals of the study of history, writing in his notes on the state of Virginia, quote, history, by apprising them of the past, will enable them to judge of the future. It will avail them of the experience of other times and other nations. It will qualify them as judges of the actions and designs of men. It will enable them to know ambition under every disguise it may assume, and, knowing it, to defeat its views. Unfortunately, for the last half century, the study of history has been in precipitous decline in the American Academy. Moreover, and perhaps not unrelated, the form of history that is most prominent within the Academy has been social or cultural history, which is rather less useful and in some cases even harmful for citizenship in a republic. Liberals and conservatives alike have occasionally called for a renewal of civic education, but too often they have only called for increased awareness of civics, that is, knowledge of the founding documents, of the structures of local, state, and federal governments, and of greater fluency in current affairs. But the founders themselves did not think that knowledge of the mechanics or even the ideas of one's own regime would suffice for a political education. They knew that genuine liberty for individuals and for societies needed substantial assistance if it were to flourish. Assistance that would be found in the form of a broad and deep education, rooted in the classical tradition, one that most certainly included the classical understanding of political history. Thank you.